Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. Today, we're joined by a very special guest who's going to break all things down neuroscience. He's going to blow our minds. It's the great Martin Den Otter. Martin, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. So we always ask the same question when we kick off a podcast. So who are you and what problem do you solve?
I'm Martin Den Otter. I'm a neuroscientist and a profiler. On the neuroscience part, I look at the brain and how we make decisions. That's my basic skill. And alongside with that, I'm a profiler. It's pretty much the same when watching a Netflix movie and you see a profiler catch a serial killer, only I do that with commercial profiles, and the combination of two gives me the opportunity to tackle difficult areas in business that require behavior manipulations in some sort, or but not manipulating in the way most people look at manipulating, but creating an environment that the brain suits best. That's basically what we do. So people often come to us either to sell more, hire more, or create something special. So their goal is always clear, but the path to that goal is always bespoke. That's the thing we do.
Wow. This guy, it's going to be great already. I can tell. So what do most people get wrong about the way decisions are made?
That's a very interesting question. Most people mix up emotions and feelings, and let me dive right into that. There is a difference between emotions and feelings. A feeling you can actually feel. That's why it's called a feeling. So if, for example, you can feel when you're in love. Everybody knows the feeling of being in love, and it's a wonderful feeling. But when you ask them, why are you in love with that person? That's when the difficulty starts. They say, oh, beautiful eyes, beautiful voice. But if I have to be in love with every person that has beautiful eyes, I would fall in love every day over and over again, being on a subway ride. And that's because our feeling is conscious. We're aware of our feelings, and we're aware of the state of mind that we are in when we experience a feeling. But what we're not aware of are our emotions. And with being in love, you have positive and negative emotions, and these emotions are building blocks to that feeling. On the positive side, we have desire. We really want this. We have lust. We also want other things with the person we're in love with. And on the negative side, there is fear. Are there other people in contention with me over the person I'm in love with? And jealousy. Does she or he love me the same way as I do? Please turn those last two around for the explanation. But that, so an emotion is a building block for a feeling. You have multiple building blocks for every feeling that you do. And what we basically do with building experiences in our part of neuroscience, and it can be an experience to buy more, hire, to apply for a job, or to be in a space that you feel excited, or you feel being able to perform better. That's when we come in, because we know how to create emotions that trigger the feeling needed to be there. And that's done with associations. And an association is basically a physical connection between two subjects in your brain. And it's made with our memories and everything that we do. Those can be real and unreal. So they can be based on facts, because the wall behind you is green, Zach. I can see that. That's a clear, direct association. But a Christmas tree is also green on the positive side, and then a Christmas tree can sting. So with the color green, I can either have a positive or negative association based purely on the association green. And our pathway is to sort out that's where the profiling also comes in. What associations do we need for this audience to trigger the right set of positive emotions to be able to give them the best possible experience? That's a very long answer for a short question, but that is the complete question. So you're basically, to get to the right feeling, we need to trigger the right emotion, in summary. And to do that, we use the right set of positive associations. And that's basically what, that's the problem that we solve. We give you the pathway.
So if I was, I always like to break it down to its simplest form. If I was a 5-year-old and I'm thinking about how we can influence others' decisions, what do I need to know in its simplest form? What do I need to know when it comes to influencing other people's decisions?
That's interesting. Look at a 5-year-old. A 5-year-old is the youthful brain is very basic. It does not have a lot of memory, so it naturally knows how to influence their parents to get what they want. So it's basically they create a right feeling by, for example, "Oh, mommy, but I love you so much. Can I please have a sweet?" And that's how they trigger the right feeling. "Oh yeah, I love you so much too. Here is a sweet." And it's a balance. Decision-making is a balance between pain or gain. And there are two parts of the brain involved in that, and it has nothing to do with any rational thinking. So you often hear people saying 95% of your decisions is made out of a gut feeling. Rationality has nothing to do with it. But it's all of them. And only when they're in balance, then rationality comes to mind. For example, if... you can actually measure this. It's how much reward do I get from this decision versus how much pain does it get? And pricing, the brain experiences real pain when we buy something, for example. And if that pain is bigger than our gain for that moment, we decide not to buy. There is no rational thought to that. And for a 5-year-old, they're really good at feeling really basic feelings that are needed and mirroring them to the adult, for example. But it's not, and that's one of the reasons why ethics, I jump from subject to subject, ethics is very important in our business, because we choose not to target children, for example, or not target casinos where we make people bet their life savings away for a game that is basically not there. And the older people get, the more associations we build, and basically the better you can influence behavior in an ethical way. And with children, that's basically impossible. However, I have a few children of my own, and when I want them to go and play outside, I give them two options. And not, "Do you want to play outside or do you want to play on the Nintendo?" No, I give them, "Hey, do you want to play outside with a ball? Or do you want to jump on a trampoline with me?" And so I'm basically manipulating them into picking one of the two choices already made for them. It's basically a Hobson choice. And when your children get older and you're in the business with me, at the tipping point of about 14 years old, they start ignoring all your good behavior. So it's experiencing that right now as well. So
we've got that all to come. I want to stick on the pain versus gain, because I hear this a lot when I'm kind of listening to podcasts or I'm reading about this, in terms of like what is the biggest influencer for change? Because obviously there could be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, which shows this massive amount of pleasure, which could be brilliant for me. But but I've heard that the rumors are that people are more likely to move towards the pain. So could you shed a bit of a light on that?
Pain is something only endured when there is actual pain. And however we steer away from any politic opinions, There is something interesting in politics where the pot of gold is often presented, and then you have the pot of gold, and there is a promise with that pot of gold. Hey, if you pick this, then I have a pot of gold for you. And then when that seems not to be the case, once we've actually cast our vote, the pain we endure is less than the gain from the promise. So a promise is always stronger than the pain of, for example, the neglect of following up with the promise. And that's why, especially in politics, people keep on lying. It's a basic study example for associations. Is also a politician lies often. That's a direct association in our brain. And if an announcement is made by a politician, then we often see that as a lie. We know that they're lying. But the promise of a better world is better than nothing at all. And that's why we keep casting votes to big promises that not come true. So it's like a fairy tale. And we tend to believe in fairy tales because our subconscious brain, you know, the part we cannot think of, does have a desire for the pot of gold. So the subconscious brain tells us, hey, this is exactly what we want. This is exactly what we want. This is your desire. So pick this, pick this, pick this. And that's what's especially in politics, they tap into that.
So it feels like, let's say me as a potential buyer, when I go out and buy something or I'm persuaded to buy something, mm-hmm. the story I'm telling myself is that was a rational decision to Absolutely. Do that.
Yeah.
But it feels like from what you're saying, it's much more of an emotional decision that's brought me there. What is the role of rational thought, if anything?
Making you think that it was a rational decision. That's basically it. So it's often the excuse for your buying behavior is rational. For example, bioproducts, study a few years back, people putting bioproducts to their shopping basket in the grocery store, 84% of them did not do that for the world. 84% of them did them to gain the status of other people around them, showing other people, hey, look what I can buy. Look how good am I for this world. So it's the reason why you buy is subconscious, so we cannot explain it. We only use rational thinking to make sense of out of our buying behavior. And there is no, only when it's really leveled out. For example, you cannot tell me why you like the car you like. And because there are probably 10, maybe 20 different car types that suit your needs better. But then again, you choose a particular brand. Why is that? We don't know, but we rationalize it to make sure our friends think that we made a common sense decision.
Wow. Are there any, let's say biases that are involved in making buying decisions that actually don't seem to make sense? They seem to be counterintuitive.
Basically all of the biases are there. Basically all. Yeah, there is, we humans have risk aversion. So the risk aversion bias is always in play. Because it's not that we do not want to make a decision, but we do not want to make a bad decision. That's a big thing, and that's why rational thinking helps us to overcome that fear. Also confirming bias. So we always find more reasons for our behavior than for the opposite of our behavior. So that's I think if you want me to point out, then those are the two I would go to.
So I want to talk a little bit about neuroscience when it comes to making effective business strategies. So like we sit down with a lot of business leaders that probably can't even spell the word neuroscience, or they don't think about it on a day-to-day basis. What Why should they be thinking about it? Why should they be bringing it into strategy and sales and things like that?
That's you're pinpointing the exact pain point of our business, because they never think about the neuroscience part of it. And they have a problem, but then again, they try to solve a problem with rationalities and measurements and tactics that are already there. But they never look into and tap into the real behavior behind a strategy, what really drives a certain behaviors. And most of the things we create from the concepting part of view, so from if we think of a concept that is driven out of the brain, is often a client who is a client for something completely else. For example, the first neural workplace that was created in this world, we invented it. And basically, our client asked us, hey, we're in contention with another architectural agency. Can you make my quote in better so that they will choose for me? And then we said, hey, but we can also not just do the quote, but revamp the entire thing and create a concept around it, where an office space is made that people actually want to be to. They had one big question. They had two types of people, and there was basically a gap in seniority between the two. But they needed to co-work on one workplace, and how can we mingle them together so it's one cohesive office space. The other problem they had huge amounts of sick leave, and it was a post-COVID era where people tend to work more from home than from the office, and they wanted them to come into the office. Then we created spaces. We first looked into the brain. We did some profiling. We did some association research beforehand. What are actually associations associated with the work they're currently working on? And then we made mood boards before any design was made. We made mood boards, and then we looked at the emotions. Basically, an fMRI scanner that scans the brain, just like the one in the hospital. We actually looked inside the brains of people. Okay, what kind of office spaces create the feeling we need to have in a certain workspace? And then we created multiple workspaces for them. Because, for example, a sales arena we created needs to add the stress. It's like the Wolf of Wall Street environment. Needs to add the stress of competition to be able to perform more. We need a higher heart rate, so more oxygen is pumped to our brain for them to perform more. On the other hand, when you want to focus and relax, and when you have that deal in hand, we want you to go to your coworker and with an ease of mind discuss what they need to do, and not just scream it in their faces, hey, I just landed this deal, please do this, or if they already say please, do this for me, do that for me. So we created a buffer zone between those two, a Tuscany garden, where you take 7 seconds to walk through the Tuscany garden in order for your heart rate to drop. And when you're out with your sales assistant, you're more at ease and you say, hey, I just landed this deal. It would be great if you can do this to me. And I'm exaggerating, of course. But meeting rooms. Why dusty old meeting rooms with bad lighting? We created half of the office is hospitality area. We made it a huge bar to meet each other. And whether it's a client, a new applicant, or your team member, you convert easier in a hospitality area where you even can take a beer or two when it's late hours. And the thing we got was the director saying on national television, his sick leave dropped by 34%. The productivity increased. And normally we had the Friday afternoon, no one was in the office. And now we have to send them away in the evening on Friday because they want to stay here. And that's all done with neuroscience. And that's not done with just the creation. And most recently I had a designer ask when I explained this, okay, but do we have to design ugly things just to make it possible and not make it sexy? And I told him, no. The sexy part is a main thing of our brain to feel good in a in a in a in a in a space. So please make it as sexy as possible, but also think of functionalities. Just give them the reasons to be in a certain space, and the certain space will flourish.
Interesting. And we have a lot of business owners that listen to the podcast. So what if they are listening, you were speaking about quotes there, about how to make their quote more appealing. If somebody is a business owner, or they work in a business that sends quotes, proposals, what can they be doing to maximize the neuroscience to make sure that they're getting ahead of the competitors?
There are some kinds of tricks that you can already do to your quote, and these are more psychology tricks. You can read a book or two about it. For example, the numbering of your quote. If it starts with 5-4, then automatically you can ask for higher prices because the price is perceived lower. These are the because if it's 1 to X on the lower end, we do not then it shifts lower. If it's on the high end number, then our research showed that they think your quote is too expensive. These are multiple things. But what people mostly forget when building a quote is, who am I selling to, and what's really important for them. And what is important for their job. So especially when you do business with large corporates, every person in a corporate has a larger agenda than just picking your quote. What can help them in their job to pick you instead of a competitor? That's also a big part of it. So it's not just, you have to really look, who am I selling to? What are their desires? And make a desire building based upon those desires. What associations do we need? And then order the content in the right order. A lot of quotes, what happens with a lot of quotes is they have 80 sheets of paper, which upon receiving, I'm scrolling through, just to see the pricing on the end of it. And everything that I've put my work into is shred to pieces if that happens to my quote. So I need to pick their attention right away and tell them, hey, this is what we're going to do today. And this is why, and make it personal as possible. Even in a high volume environment, you can make quotes feel personal to them. And it's different when quoting everyday items that are sold in a high velocity, and it's just for the price. When they just seek pricing, just give pricing. But when they seek a solution, give them a solution that drives on their needs.
So as someone who knows so much about the brain, about buyers, about behavior, how do you feel about AI? You're probably someone who'd have a very interesting opinion on it.
Absolutely wonderful. It's okay. Absolutely wonderful, because it makes everything so much easier in the world. And it makes, for example, we used to work only for big corporates. And because in neuroscience, it's quite expensive to do an entire research. And AI provided us, together with our experience, provided us with fast, for example, eye tracking research and some parts of EEG research we can do with AI, which has a 95% success rate. And instead of 2 weeks' time to do a research, we have it overnight. So and our client, we can make it available for the large public. And you should embrace it, because if you do not embrace it, and if you not go with it, then you're finished before you know it.
Does it pose any risks? Because from some of the stuff you said on this podcast, I'm sure there's so much more. It feels like the human brain is hackable. There's little cons to it. They probably helped us with survival, but yeah, maybe now in a capitalist world, actually that you're hackable now. So is there a risk that AI can put that on a huge scale?
Let me jump into something where it can help the world, AI, where it has already helped the world. I'm I'm also into tech business, and I really like tech because it's I'm a nerd, so that's makes sure I love tech. And with one of our tech partners, we built IamSafe. IamSafe is basically a woman's safety app for domestic to counter domestic violence, and it has. If you're in danger, you scream out your personal safe word, and then your location and data goes to five friends in order for them to be able to help you, stored in blockchain. But when the app was running for over a year, they also added a restore function. And now we, with AI and with the data profiling and neuroscience, we can detect if somebody is talking on the platform, whether they're actually suffering from domestic violence, and then we can nudge them to do something about it. And that you have to think about, what can I do to make my life better? Not what can I do to make other people's life shittier, or just and that's the big part of it. So it's AI, we live in a world where AI, you cannot shut your eyes for it. And if you're still shutting your eyes for it, you'll soon be over. That's a thing. So you should embrace it and think, how can this better my life, and how can this better the life of the people surrounding me, and make it work for me? Because yes, the brain is hackable to some extent. And if it's not, you have particular brains that are completely different than others. And these, at least for me, are very interesting, because something is different with that person and what's it. So then you tap into, for example, criminal behaviors or lack of empathy and such. And I like those people, but it's more like I'd rather watch a disordered brain than a Netflix series. So that's my part of it. So it's
okay. You mentioned status before as a driver for people.
Yeah.
It's something that I read Will Storr's book recently on status. It's something that is interesting to me. Do you think it's possible to reach a level of status where you're satisfied, or do you think the status game is something that just continues to evolve?
The thing with status is that once you achieved your level of desire, it shifts, because status is often done to not for yourself, but for others. It's basically proving to others, look what car I can buy, look what life I can live. And as soon as I've reached that, you tap into a new community with more people that have that series of life and have that series of things around them. So, and then you want the desire for even more is always there. And then it keeps growing and growing and growing and growing. And it's like that need is not just status. They just want to prove. It's just proof. Hey, look what I can do. People often have an awareness of and a need for constantly scoring. It's a dopamine rush every single time. For example, the movie Wolf of Wall Street. I really like that movie because that basically describes the need for constant scoring, even if other people around me are not lacking. And there's a good line in that. He made 42 million a year. One moment, please. Hey, vriend. Even aan de kant. That was my son.
Don't worry. Happens all the time.
There is a line in that movie where he said, I made $49 million in that year. And it pissed me off because I was close to 1 million shy. It was shy of being 1 million a week. So that perfectly describes a feeling of how many people do you know that make $49 million a year, especially in 88 when he was doing it. And then it pissed him off because he always wanted something more and something better. And that as a human is normal. You also want better, more and such. but status, yeah, it's constantly evolving. And but not only in the money part. People that, for example, live entirely off grid also use that as a status symbol, and they have basically not a competition to have as much as possible, but have as few as possible. So look, I'm fully my car runs on biodegradable energy. Hey, my car runs entirely off solar power. Hey, I don't even need a car. And that's also status, and it works both ways. And we often forget that. And status is a driver that drives us all, but only in the parts where we think it's valuable.
You were talking about the Wolf of Wall Street there, and obviously we're a sales company, and a lot of salespeople listen to this podcast. For those that don't have the budget of $49 million a year, what are some of the things they can do with limited to zero budget to help motivate their team, from maybe a leadership standpoint or maybe from an office standpoint? What are some of those kind of things that they can be doing proactively?
Tap into desires of your sales team. We made a sales arena, so we know what emotions and what feelings are needed to drive a sales team to perform. But then again, there is one big factor, and that's we need to get them into the sales arena, which is basically a stressful environment where the stress is added to perform. We need go-getters to be willingly putting themselves into a stressful situation to score. And that's the most important part. And that's our client had a huge budget. But if you are, for example, you have a home office and you need to do your first sales as a self-employed person, even then you can surround yourself with things that to make sure you do the things needed to sell. And it's not, if you tap into the desires of a sales team, then you know what drives them to go to that sales room and what that drives them to do the sales. And with Wolf of Wall Street, is do you want to solve the problems in your life? Yes, then pick up the phone and start dialing. He was basically targeting the poor and told them, hey, you want a different life? Here is your different life. But now we've got these Ivy League salespeople, they're coming trained right out of college, thinking they know what it is to be a top performing sales agent. And that's just not happening. So you need to know, why is this Ivy League salesperson in sales? What is their motivation to be here? And is it money? Okay, then we have to give them money. Is it freedom, which is often the thing? Then we have to offer them freedom. And that's how basically you shape it, you tailor around the team or even the people themselves. What is their need? They have one, for example, a lot of, I give you a thing. We, for hospitality letting agency, targeted a lot of students who wanted a job in hospitality. And then we looked at that. How can we motivate them more to have to invite their friends to come work for us as well? Because the one-off money, here is 50 euros when you bring a friend, was not doing it. And then we made it, we looked at their desires, and a hot item then was a sustainable income. So money where you don't have to do anything for. The 4-hour work week kind of money. So what did we think of? Okay, there is a recruitment budget. We have a recruitment budget, and we have people that do not want to work but do want the money. So if we, instead of putting these campaigns, money into campaigns and run ads, what if we tell them, for every hour your friend works, you get X amount of euros. And if they bring friends as well, you get X amount of euros for that as well. And with that, you have an income without actually having to work for it. And then when it landed to the right amount of people, we tackled two things. A lot of applicants were coming in because now they were making money without them working. and they only got paid when their friends are working. So we also, which was not initiated, we had a management layer that was telling their friends, hey, come work on this job with me. Hey, come work on this job. Hey, do you want to work on that job as well? Without having to push for it. So we had a management layer and a recruitment layer just by thinking of, hey, what is the desire of a young student to work with us?
So it sounds like obviously the secret is finding out others' motivations and desires. I guess what are some of your favorite questions when customers come to you and you're trying to find out what their motivations are or their desires are, and you're trying to work out how I get them from A to B? What are some of your favorite questions to ask?
The favorite question to ask is, what do they hate the most? What do you absolutely hate about your job, which we can make easier for you? Because people often do not know what they like, but they do know what they hate. And then they will start building a list for you with all the things they hate. They can name it out of the top of their mind. And that's where their pain is. And if we take away the pain, we automatically get a gain.
Beautiful. Martin, I've really enjoyed the conversation. It feels like we could probably have gone on for another few hours, but maybe we save this for part two. If people have listened to this and they say, I want to inject a bit of Martin's brain power into my business, where would they start that journey? Where's best?
There are two, my LinkedIn page, of course, and contact me, or at neurofactor.agency. That's the page that suits best.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you. For this stage, I really enjoy talking about my part. So anytime.